So I'm going to talk today about common envelope. And this is a very uncertain subject, right? So before I will deep in, I will explain a little bit my vocabulary. When I say we know and we think, it means that it's the best scientific theory at the moment, which doesn't mean that it's true, but it's the best by my opinion, and it was kind of confirmed by some studies. If I say it might be, it means that it was published, but even I don't trust it. So, I mean, just don't be upset with me saying we know, because in my head it's kind of related to the best available hypothesis. Okay. So the basics are pretty easy, right? It was about 40 years ago, then it was related that you somehow have to create closed binaries, very compact binaries, and those stars being at the beginning, kind of big. And it took some years to relate the binary energy of the envelope to the orbital energy available, and the alpha formulas, which have been created in the 80s, roughly in 84 by Ron Bebbing, and then a little bit fine-tuned in 87 by Lydia and
Soker,
yes. It is in simplicity, you say that you relate the change in the orbital energy to the binding energy of the envelope. Now, so here, you say that your delta E orbit is the energy which is available. That's pretty much straightforward. You take the initial energy, which is orbital energy of your two stars, the initial orbital separation, and that is your final energy where you think that out of the second star only the corners left, and this is your final orbital separation. Obviously, this one is usually much, much bigger than this one, so you really, you may not care when you make some preliminary estimates. Now, alpha here is efficiency of the use of the orbital energy, which from some point of view can tell you that if you just think that it's the all energy available, then by the energy conservation law, alpha has to be less than 1. Okay? Now, just listen what order I will come. Now, this thing, when you compare just the initial state and the final state, may make sense only during a dynamical event. Okay? Then you can neglect completely all the possible other energy sources and energy losses. What we now think, remember it's best available hypothesis, is that the common envelope is not just a dynamic when you have an initial stage and the final stage and then it transits from one to another, but assume that this is time, and time here will have different scales over this time scale, or over this axis. So here is, that will be orbital separation, and the blue will be the radius of the star. So roughly speaking, one can cartoonishly show that the orbital separation goes like this. Now the reaction of the star will be something like this. Now, what is usually called as a common envelope, when you see this cartoon with the two stars where one overfills the Roche-Lop and butts, and you have a compact star, is this. Okay? This is so-called Planck in-phase. And that will act on a dynamical timescale of the initial binary. Okay? That's an important thing because when you down to here, that already could be many, many, many orbits of your forming binary. But the overall time scale of the plunging will be rather related to the initial time scale of your initial binding. Now, so this.
Sorry, what was the blue axis? I think I mixed
it. It's a Radisson star, so called Common Envelope. Okay? So now, so here, what is going on is called usually as a curvation, loss of curvation. It's basically when you have your initial star, it starts to slowly expand. It starts with atmospheric mass, Roche-Lomb overflow, or anything, but that stage can be long. Okay, so it can be 10 to 3, 10 to 4 years. It's not fully understood, fully calculated, because the time scale are long, and we don't have proper 3D models for the mass of Roche overflow during this stage. However, with the best models which we have for that stage, where we also use a 3D potential, we know that this stage can take 10 to 3 to 24 years. The mass transfer rate also can be high. And for example, if you say it's a 20, 30 solar mass star, it can lose several solar masses during this stage. So whenever you come to the plunging stage, you do not have the initial envelope mass as you do before. Okay? So some mass lost here.
I was going to say transferred, right? You don't know it's lost from the system, right?
Well, it's normal mass overflow, so you treat it away, it may be creating jets or whatever. Anyway, it's a mass which is transferred to another companion before you start the real common envelope.
Can I ask, when in this would you fill L2?
Yes. So, our best hypothesis is that the common envelope's real plunging stage starts when you overflow to L2 or L3, whatever it is, point. Because that's the only way how you can start dynamical evolution of your system. The L1 overflow can be very high, but it still doesn't mean that you start a common envelope.
Natasha?
Yes.
Before, when you're overfilling the Roche lobe but you haven't reached L2 and L3, would you call that an overcontact binary?
I'm not that good with terms.
I always get confused when I see a peanut star.
Yeah.
Is that a common envelope phase? Is that a...
No.
Okay, that's still co-rotating.
That's my guess.
I think that's overcontact.
Yeah. That's overcontact. Okay. And that's still perfectly stable. Things only go wrong when it starts shedding out of L2 and L3?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not wrong. They just go fast.
Okay.
Yeah. You mentioned the difference between radiative envelopes and convective envelopes. Because
well, that's a return for stability, but...
I'm not talking about stability. I'm talking about how much mass we have in this overflow region.
Well, okay. So you may lose different amount of mass during this loss of cavitation phase, and that will depend on your envelope quality. But let's move on here, because this stage is not yet calculated even any close to the plunging phase. The plunging phase is actually the best calculated now because it's the dynamical, and the high dynamical cots can't deal with that. Now, so fairly with terminology. Now, so here we know that if the envelope was not ejected by this point when you have dynamical evolution of the orbit, so roughly speaking, then you like change by 10 to the minus 2 over orbital period, or orbital separation over the orbital period, right? So then you go out to the much slower change of the orbit here, and the envelope was not ejected. What we call here is a self-regulated stage. I mean, it could be coming differently. It's a thermal self-regulated, whatever. But the point here is that now you think that the rate at which your orbital energy is deposited will be radiated away. You have now very high, very large envelope, and the star has expanded, and it radiates away lots of energy. So here, you already have to deal with different energy sources, also nuclear and radiative losses from the surface, which are comparable to the overall energy budget, okay? So this alpha formula is completely unapplicable to this stage. Now, so what also we have at the end is that at some point, and I will talk later, the envelope will become unstable. It may become early unstable, but at some point it will become unstable, and it may have delayed dynamical ejection, or it will be having energy eventually. So, but that will be the end. Yes.
So, the slope of the white line gives the time scale. You say there's a dynamical phase and then it slows down.
Yeah.
Can you say what physics sets this time scale? So why?
Okay, so here, what is going on here, and that's actually trouble for many hydrocarbons, is, so you plant, you deposit energy in the envelope. Envelope pops up. Now, the mass of the envelope is well above your orbit. Basically, the ratio of the way your envelope is concentrated to the orbit is more than 6 or 9. It's really hard now to transfer any orbital energy to the envelope. And the orbit depletion stops. There's really, really little of matter around the orbit, so there is no viscous friction as well. So that slows down the orbital depletion.
So you assume here that you have a certain density structure that that you reach a strong density gradient during the plunging, or
the envelope expands and then you reach a density where the friction luminosity is then roughly equal to, well, it's equal to the surface luminosity.
Well, that's the assumption in 1D codes. I'm now talking about the result of the 3D codes. So in 3D codes, here you just have mechanical energy plunged in the envelope. Envelope, push stop. And then there's just little matter around the orbit. Okay? In reality, it doesn't cover the whole variety of possible common envelopes, possibly, but I'm just talking about that. What we see in all hydrocarbons is that the orbit depletes. Orbital depletion decreases strongly. And that's actually one of the problems for a long time, because in hydrocarbons there was no observed complete common envelope ejection. And the reason is exactly in that. You cannot transfer the orbital energy to the envelope if the envelope is strongly packed up.
That maybe fully opposite this question. So you're talking a lot about transferring energy from the orbit into the to the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it would be nice to discuss, at least in the models, what is the main physical mechanism that operates that transfer?
Okay, so it depends on the stage again, because here,
right,
it's literally mechanical kinetic.
In the dynamical phase.
It's mechanical energy, basically it's kinetic energy and potential energy.
Right, but you have to swap this energy, and the way, the mechanism that does that set the time scale for the process.
I think different codes reach different conclusions, right?
Okay, right. That's so it's important.
The runtime is keen on these spiral wave things, right?
You can call it differently, because it's all gravitational interaction and whatever kind of density perturbation you create. I mean, it's all terminology, right? But the point is here is that you don't really use any thermal energy, and there is no really much of the time to make some viscous friction and transfer from the viscous friction. So I call it just mechanical energy. And then you can go into details about how you call it spiral waves or not spiral waves, but
I feel like those details are extremely important. Because,
yeah. But I don't. I mean, so I don't quite understand. I mean, you're saying it happens in dynamical time scale, but it seems difficult for any kind of friction or spiral waves, whatever, to operate on dynamical time scale. I mean, it seems like that should be a longer time scale process.
Not really. So the thing is that you can call it the spiral waves, but what you create is tidal bulges during this stage. So it's you create tidal bulges here behind, and they drag. So it's a gravitational drag in some sense, which drags back your companion, and then it just falls down. Also, and through that, you lose the angular momentum. That's the main mechanism by which the companion drops down. But you cannot lose angular momentum without losing energy. And so there's how it works.
The question is that then that's some friction time scale, which depends on the mass ratio and how much what the mass of the envelope is you're going through. And it is not, I mean, it might be 100 dynamical times, I think is the question.
I didn't see it to be 100 dynamical times in any simulation. So it may vary by few of initial orbital periods, but this characteristic time scale of a plunge, it varies depending on the mass of the companion, but I didn't see any results to be longer than about 10 of initial orbital periods. So maybe it is a function, and it's also a function of a chord or whatever you have as numerical viscosity there, but it's pretty subtle within this range.
If you refer to numerical simulations, what I grasp is that the range of parameters which has been assessed in numerical simulations is still very small. Like, there's not much done for massive stars, most is done for low mass stars, and, you know, so this could change the picture a lot.
It may, yes. There is no 3D simulations for massive stars. For the plunging
phase. This is a massive star workshop.
I cannot create a sequel for your plunging simulation of massive stars. So I'm talking about what we know, okay?
But I mean, in order for these tidal bulges, for example, you know, to operate the dynamical friction on something like a few times the dynamical time scale, I mean, you basically have to have a mass anisotropy, or sort of the mass in these bulges has to be almost comparable to the mass of the cores.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the dynamical time scale is set by the mass of the cores. Right? So you've got to, a significant fraction of the mass has to be very anisotropically distributed.
Well, you create anisotropy as you go in. Not initially.
Then I still don't quite understand how it can happen on only a few dynamical time scales. Okay.
Maybe I can't explain that. I mean, we can look up how the simulation look like and how the energy is transferred. I mean, I have different ways how to estimate how the energy is transferred, but not the way how you ask.
If you look just at the dynamical drag that you get, from very simple, you get luminosity is very high. So the fact that it can happen on a dynamical timescale is not surprising. I think that the details of the slope of that curve will depend on how this process works, which is a very complicated physical situation.
So dissipate an enormous amount of energy. It's
right.
Like the space shuttle getting into the atmosphere. It gets accelerated when that happens. And this star gets accelerated when it spirals in. So it must get enormous friction and enormous energy loss. The time scale is probably very short, I would think.
What? Is it obvious which phase dominates the mass loss? Namely, your first phase?
Not. And I will try to come to that if I will have time, because I'm just moving from my first page. Okay. So now, we have to play some kind of fundamental energies, which you can call them potential. Well, fundamental is potential, kinetic, and thermal. Now, so the thermal energy is the one which goes into this binding energy, well, plus gravitational energy. Potential energy and initial kinetic energy of the orbit goes into here. What you can notice already, that one component is lost from the alpha formalism, and that component is related to the plausible kinetic energy of an envelope at infinity. So the alpha formalism intrinsically implies that the ejection was so fine-tuned that the material at the infinity has zero kinetic velocity, and it's unplausible, okay? So one thing is just missed here, and we try to work on, but it's really hard, it's how much kinetic energy material will have at infinity. From the simulation that we have, is about 30-40%, so basically what I want to say is that it's missed in here, but it's not negligible number, really not negligible number.
Natasha,
mm-hmm.
What about the difference in binding energy of the core?
I will come to that. Now, so when people play with just those three energies, and here as the thermal energy, I mean just the thermal energy of the gas as P rho blah 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 plus radiation AT4, and they try to put it straightforward in the code, what has happened usually is that the envelope doesn't want to fly away. And that was a problem for some time. So we had to play with different additional things to try to recover the envelope ejection. Because we know from an energy like comparison, you can create a binary, but it is hard to transfer energy to the envelope once it's packed up. Now, so what I call as non-fundamental energies, although they, of course they boil down to the fundamental, one of them is what you can consider is accretion on a companion during the common envelope. Okay, so especially if you can think that, especially if you have a compact accretor and it spirals in and it accretes at the Eddington rate, then it might be a good sufficient energy source. Now that could work out as a radiating away from just like Eddington luminosity, but it also may create jets. In some sense, jets are more convenient because they directly deposit kinetic energy, right? I mean, it's not just radiation that you have to then reprocess in the thermal and then to move the envelope. But jets.
But it's also not Eddington limited. Bianfei can give you outflows that carry much more than the Eddington luminosity.
So jets are convenient. And Nomsocker works on that. If you have a limited by Eddington, with whatever reason, then the and the spiral in is about initial dynamical time scale, then you can find that this energy source can become important. So E binding is comparable to your L Eddington on dynamical time scale if the radius of a star initial is roughly more than 1,000 solar radii. And actually, I can hear Shukadanda. Now, our source, which is non-fundamental, which can play a role, are magnetic fields. And I think you worked on this, right? So magnetic fields have interesting consequences. They can shape up the outflows, which is nice because you can test it, right? I think that because the observations of formed nebulas, post-common envelope nebulas, are way better than anything that we have for the common envelope themselves. I believe that
the current... What's an example of an observed post-common envelope nebula?
Oh, there's a plenty. I mean, yeah, I can give you references by Ursula Demarque because she works exactly on tracing those guys. But I will not cite them from my head.
But meaning it's these are systems where we know
yes,
it was a binary.
Because the central is a compact binary.
Okay.
I think a lot of planetary nebula have compact binaries.
Agreed, but I think it's still debated whether those, that's what I was kind of getting at. Those planetary nebulae, it's not guaranteed that that's ejection from common envelope and not.
Whether it's the binary is small enough. If it's inside the
Okay, so literally in the sense that it's so small, you know it. You don't know that the ejector was driven by these processes, not.
Right.
But I understand.
Yeah. The binary is much more compact than the AGB stars.
Yes.
Now, but so what I believe is currently thought is that all last simulations with magnetic field, he said that even though magnetic fields are interesting, they are dynamically irrelevant to the common envelope ejection.
So one thing about the magnetic fields is the magnetic fields in the envelope itself, but there's also whatever it is, the jets, for example, the jets, if there were jets on the accretion. The magnetic fields are really always just a byproduct of having some other form of energy, like either rotation, differential rotation, either from accretion or from something else. So they're really an intermediary more than they are like a binary.
And so our source, which is arguable, but may play a role in some cases, is a nuclear, is then during the merger, during the latest stage of your orbital depletion, your companion starts to overflow its Roche law, then if your giant had a helium layer or something, then this hydrogen from your companion can tap in and create something there. Now, so all those are specific cases, but with the very specific cases, you cannot explain the majority.
At the risk of derailing, do you remember where Ullmann found that the magnetic fields affected the viscosity?
But I don't remember.
not so much. I think that's the question he's asked. I think he's asked. It looked too much at Pisassi, but I think that that was not what he said.
That's what I'm going to talk to next, because that's more related to fundamental energy. Now we come to recombination energy, and I will spend most time on this.
To play devil's advocate in terms of energy sources.
Pardon?
To play devil's advocate in terms of energy sources, accretion and nuclear are way more important than recombination.
By the amount of energy, yes, but they could not explain the most.
Okay.
So, I mean, my thesis was on this, right? But I will not be advocating that this works out.
Especially for normal stars. For normal stars, not for compact objects.
Now, the recombination energy. If you think about how much energy is stored in the star, it's lots. We can write it down as that. Any recombination is roughly 2.6 on 10 and 46. Now here will be the envelope mass and solar masses. And here I will multiply it on the fraction of material which become neutral in hydrogen, then helium which will become singly ionized, and helium which will become neutral. So roughly speaking, for normal composition, it will be 3 on 10 and 46 on envelope mass in solar masses. You can now compare that to the binding energy, and the binding energy, which I didn't write before, but should have. Is the mass of your donor on the mass of a core, here G, and here comes lambda, which I also will talk about, on the radius of your donor. Now, so lambda here is a structural parameter which relates your real, so-called real, thermal energy to this simplified equation. When initially the binding energy was derived for low-mass stars, it actually worked perfectly, because if you will try to look on low-mass stars and their giants, this lambda will be around 1 to 2. But then it was applied for some time to massive stars without realizing that this lambda could be much smaller. And I think Philip was working on this, and he showed that lambda in massive stars is way, way smaller than 1 or 2. Now, so if you will compare recombination energy.
Excuse me, what was RD there again?
Sorry?
RD or something.
Radius of a donor to start all the common envelope. So, I mean, in some sense, you'll relate it to integral of an envelope of whatever you're plugging as your real binding energy of the envelope. There will be your thermal energy, your potential energy, some other. Now, so lambda. Now, if you compare those two energy, then once the radius of your donor is about 127 solar radii divided by lambda, a star can be said to have positive initial total energy, because that is as much of recombination energy as is stored inside your star. Now, but recombination energy, in many senses, is a potential energy, because even though it's stored, you still have to use it. Okay, you have to treat it, and you have to make use of it. So first of all, you have to trigger it, so you have to cool down your material, but you also have to capture and make use of it, right? Because in many cases, you can argue that even if your recombination happens, the radiation which was created by recombination will fly right away. And then it's completely useless.
I haven't thought about this, but by this argument, all stars are unbound because they have fusion energy.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I say. It's a potential energy, but it's not directly used.
Right. So what have you done with the masses? You have mass of the envelope for the E-combination.
Mm-hmm.
You have mass of the core and mass of the, right? Is that the donor? Yeah, mass of the donor.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the masses go away when you wrote this relation?
I think I just used the same mass, roughly.
Of course, the core envelope or same mass.
I thought the envelope was the sloppy stuff, and the core was back basically the stuff that's part of the stars. I didn't think they were the same thing.
So most of the binding energy is very close to the core, right? So the bottom of the envelope, which means it actually is square and certain depending on where you put the bottom.
This is really important.
Yes. But also notice that for lambda, for massive star is less than 0.1, so basically it will be true only for very, very massive, for very, very sparse, big stars. Now.
So with the recombination, I mean, is it sort of less, you have the energy already there in the thermal form, ether with star.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of where you then release that energy.
Yes.
And how. Above that location, whether the binding energy is less than
Natasha, it's like whether it was included in that thermal category or not.
It's never
for you. It's not for the EOS.
It's not included by anyone.
By any EOS.
It's usually, if it's included, it's included separately.
Okay, I've been told repeatedly that it's in the EOS. So we should someday maybe get straight on that. In other words, the EOS knows about recombination energy and will tell you a different value. It will tell you that the thermal energy of a blob has changed when I go to a state where it is now in typically going to be recombined versus what it was.
It depends on how you define your internal energy.
That's what I'm saying, exactly. And so it's either there or not.
But what I say is that when usually people find the binding energy of the envelope, it's not included. Because it was always been argued.
Because it's in that thermal energy term that you didn't include.
Yes.
So it is in the thermal energy, which means it is there if you calculate the total energy of the star, including that thermal energy. It's just a matter you've transferred it out of this hidden form inside the thermal energy.
No. I mean, when you calculate it by taking the thermal energy of a gas plus 84, it's not included in there. And this is what was usually used to find the binding energy of the envelopes.
So that definition of thermal energy explicitly excludes that. Okay.
Because it's never been clear whether you can make use of that energy or not.
Great. So I'm thinking about it in terms of MESA or something like that. Our definition of internal energy that we get from OPAL and the EOSs, I believe, includes that. But again, I'm not clear on this. I'm just a computer scientist. How would I?
So it's the picture of something
I cannot say because.
Yeah, no, I understand. There's just vast confusion
at this point. It's the picture of something like the dynamical phases puff things out, it recombines. Now you tap into the center.
Yes, so I'm coming to that. Now, so for lambda, now the lambda is another thing which is.
I now vividly understand the question, but I see the problem that E binds goes mass squared and E red goes mass, and even if you imagine that you set mass squared equals mass envelope, I don't see how you cancel those.
Did I see?
Okay, so
you do the integration and then lambda fixes the number.
So it's not because something you put in.
Assuming they're both energies, they have the right units, right? You've really messed up if they don't actually have the units of
energy. No, they have the right units, but I don't understand how you can express our donor in terms of only the solar radius unless you make some additional assumptions about the mass. Because you cannot cancel mass squared with mass, right?
There's a mass dependence.
I mean, RD should be a function of mass somehow.
There is a mass dependence, yeah.
Okay.
I'm a little bit confused now because it
is just
somehow it worked out completely well, but whatever.
So the sum is 200 already.
So about the lambda, and its uncertainty, especially for massive stars. That goes back to work by Thomas Torres, 15 years ago, 2008 or something, 2002. So if you will type, so assume that this is a mass coordinate inside a massive star. Well, it's 20 solar masses. This is the region between 5.5 and 8.5 solar masses. Now, so here, I'll plot lambda as calculated down to that mass coordinate. And here will be like 0.05 where I start. So the behavior of that lambda within this layer will be something like this.
Sorry, and this is because R is defined to be the total radius, not some local radius.
Yes, okay. But the point is that it's not about what is R as defined. The point is where you start your integration, what you define as the bottom of the envelope which you want to eject. Because the further down to the core you go, the more body energy you have to spend. Right? So here, and this is related to the question, what is your remnant after the common envelope ejection? So here will be like I say zero, but let's say it's less than 10 and minus 4, because it never becomes zero. It becomes 10 and minus 24 in equilibrium or something. Now, so here will be the bottom of a convective envelope. So depending on whether you say that you eject everything down to hydrogen-exhausted core or to the bottom of a common envelope event, the difference in lambda is about 50 times. So the question is how you define where is your start of integration, right? So that is really, really important for massive stars, not for low-mass stars. Low-mass stars, it's kind of easier. But just to say that different orders have used different definitions of post-common envelope remnants, and depending on what you pick, will be actually your post-common envelope binary. But just keep in mind that just that definition gives you uncertainty of 15 times at least for the case of 20. Yes.
But this refers really to just the very, very simplest formalism, the lambda formalism, right? Because
no, it's not related to the simple formulas. It's related to the question, what do you define as the envelope which will be ejected?
No, because if you have a certain orbit energy to spend, why don't you go as far as you can until you've reached the point that your energy, your orbit energy is equal to the binding energy?
No. The question is, so when you do a common envelope ejection, do you just inject the common envelope? Then you have a relatively wide binary, or you have to eject a part of your helium layer. Then it will be when you have a much shorter binary, or maybe you'll have a merger. So the question is, what do you think will be the end?
Well, I agree that there is further questions, like whether the layers below will re-expand once the envelope is going up, like that.
I think normally it's an integral equation. You start at some separation, you move in, and you ask. Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree.
If you want to just deal with a formal energy criterion, I think you can do very well without any lambda as long as you know the stellar structure. And we do know the stellar structure, so the lambda is no issue.
No. That's not the issue. The issue is where you start your integration. That's the issue. Lambda is just the easy way to show that your binding energy will differ by 15 times depending on whether you choose this M bottom from here to here.
If you set that equal to the change in orbital energy, that's some condition, a well-defined condition. Are you saying there's actually an infinite number of solutions?
Yeah, but yes, that's the point. That's the problem, because people try to find post-common envelope orbital separation based on what they think is the energy which they have to spend. If you know what's your post-orbital separation, it's different, but you want to find it.
I mean, it's a question of the efficiency with which the energy is converted into the ejected.
So that's the alpha. That's the alpha. Alpha, I agree, is a problem, yes. But the lambda, to me, is no problem.
No. It's not the lambda that is problem. The problem is the start of your integration.
Yeah, which the end point of your integration. I was thinking from out to so far in until my orbital energy equals the binding energy.
He's going to set the inner by the...
But you're assuming that you know what the final state is. You're assuming all that you know what your energy budget is.
You assume the energy budget and that sets the inner boundary.
Exactly. I really disagree with that because, for example, you can say that I have as much energy, I'm going to integrate, and here is my stop. But you cannot stop here because the connective envelope will start to re-expand. So you need to know what's your physical limitation on your stop. On the other hand, what I found is that as you move in, then it's really impossible to take the mass from some point which is here the real maximum within this layer, because when you try to take the mass out of that, it will shrink inside. So you cannot really go down there. So you have to have some additional physical constraint about what
you can mass determine you can... the point at which, if you take all the matter off, things would collapse.
Yes.
And the point above which they will expand. And that would be a useful point.
Yeah, that's my definition. But however, I don't say that it's completely correct definition. Okay, so I call this as a compression point, whatever. But I only did that for the range of the stars, of massive stars, and I don't know whether it works every time or whether it will work in 3D hydro.
Right. This would check this criteria for the more massive stars. Say this on a massive star, and it doesn't work very well.
So you did you check on the contraction and expansion?
I checked it independently from that paper. So the paper sort of seems to point that this is way inside the core. And if you actually do a mass loss calculation, your star contracts way above that. And it gives you an order of magnitude difference in lambda.
Ultimately, you're still talking about the same thing.
Yes.
The way how we define the stretchable point.
Yes.
Yeah, so but the point is that this critical point has to be defined, and it's not should be found from your like integration inside using the orbit. But you should not stop your orbital separation by the time when you complete the energies. It has to be some additional constraint.
Depends on time scale, so it's very different.
You finished the second page yet?
Gosh.
Intermission and go again.
Right. Now, so what I said about lambda, and so that point is very important for massive stars. Now, I will come back to recombination energy. Not very well understood, but we can start something from like very close dynamically to the point when it climbs in and try to simulate. What is going on is then the companion sinks, the envelope puffs up, and the envelope is becoming dynamically decoupled from the orbit. So that's the problem number one. Now, during this plunge, then you transfer first lots of mechanical energy in the envelope, a fraction of envelope is dynamically ejected. So that's the first loss of the mass. So it's a dynamical ejection during the plunge. It varies between 20% and 40% for the cases when we know in advance that there should be a successful binary formation in different cores. It will be about a few percent at least for the cases when we know it will be no binary formation, so basically it's a merger. So one point to take from here is that if you model mergers or some other objects with your massive stars, a few percent of the mass of the envelope will be lost anyway during that stage, even the if there would be no binary formation. So then we have this puffed up. Envelope. What you can look at is that how far this envelope from the binary hits. That's what we did with our unsuccessful common envelope objections. Now you can find, by equating the amount of a potential energy, specific potential energy of that particle, with a specific energy and which that particle can get if it will be recombined. And so one can find that if a location of a particle is above, I call it a recombination radii for hydrogen, for helium it will be just different quantity. If it's above 105 solar radii, and here multiplied on the M graph, so M graph is the mass within, basically it could be just a binary or some additional mass of the envelope. So then, if that particle will recombine, and if that energy can be used, then it's enough energy to remove the particle to infinity. Now the question, of course, whether you can or cannot use that energy. And that question relates to how deep, in optical sense, you are located at the time when you do recombination. What we found is that the recombination takes place very deep inside. It's harder to prove for hydrogen, although...
Deep means optical depth of... One.
It's not just one. What I want to show you is it's not a recombination front whatsoever. Whatever you thought before about how the recombination front looked like, it's not how it looked like in a star.
So we don't know the optical depth?
The optical depth is many, because it's not measured just in optical depth. So this is mass, in solar masses. So here I will draw recombination fraction. So there will be, it's of course for the low mass star, but the point is that the low mass star will become at some, maybe comparable to the massive star. So here 1.6, here is roughly half of the of the initial envelope. So that will be how your hydrogen recombination profile look like. What I want to say is that it's within like a half a solar mass. It's
free electrons. I love electrons. Neutrons,
like fraction of a neutral hydrogen. No, ionized hydrogen. So this is one. That will be for hydrogen, and for helium is something like this, the first and second. The point here is that the range of the masses where you have partial recombined material is huge. We are not talking about optical depth of one. We're talking about like one solar mass of a material where you have partial recombination and reprocessing of that recombination.
Are you saying you ionized outside? Are you saying you ionized
outside? No, this is zero.
Opposite. Yeah, you have H2, right? Or proton or something.
The fraction of H2, you changed it. You changed it to fraction of ionized hydrogen.
Yes.
It's confusing.
Yes.
H1 there.
Fraction of ionized. Fraction of seconds, 2 times ionized helium, fraction of once ionized helium, fraction of once ionized hydrogen.
What does that look like in a red giant? How much mass? So you go from neutral to ionized?
Half a solar mass.
No, in a red giant.
That is a red giant.
That is a red giant.
That's fine. Yeah. Sorry, I thought this was...
Well, it's a puffed up stage of a red giant.
Yes. It's not normal red giant.
Okay.
It's the result of the common envelope.
So this is happening over an optical depth range.
it goes all the way down to 10 to the fourth, probably.
Well, so when I try to calculate the optical depth, so you can reach about 1% of hydrogen, ion, like a 1% of ionized hydrogen at about optical depth, maybe 10 to the four. So maybe some fraction of a recombination from hydrogen would be lost, but I mean, because like 10 and 4 above and it's 1%. But it's the loss is reprocessed here.
But it gets up to 10% ionized by 10 to the third. Probably.
That's on your capacity source.
Yeah, of course. I'm just saying that it's way below what we would ever think about as
photosphere. Once you recombine the hydrogen, the dominant opacity is like H minus, and that's much less than electron scattering.
No, of course,
So you can see deeper in,
right?
So the optical depth is less.
But we're talking about a static situation here. We've grabbed a red giant, it's superinflated. We're going to calculate an optical depth for that particular state at that time. So we know what the opacities are at that time. They're going to change later, but at that time we know what it is. So we can attempt to calculate an optical depth profile versus mass like this and compare it to the ionization fraction profile like this to get some idea of what our current instantaneous optical depth is. And all that's going to change dramatically, of course, as you ionize things or neutralize them. The capacities change and the optical depth changes dramatically.
As instantaneous, do you mean local? Because I
would assume
that optical depth was integrated from surface.
That's I am too, but it's just
down to whatever place at any time. There's no time dependence of optical depth calculation.
It is definitely a spatial integration over time. In one particular snapshot in time, assuming one particular set of opacities.
But I think as Stan pointed out last week, right, most of the optical depth is local within one pressure scale, right?
Well, yeah, in hydrogen equilibrium.
So that argument's, so where is, mark tau equals 1 on that plot, please.
It's probably 1.6 or
something.
It's kind of a star. Somewhere here, when the fraction of ionized hydrogen is less than 1%.
My next question is mark tau equals 100.
Then tau is more than 10,000.
Great.
Yeah. So, I mean, the further down you go, it will be on the bigger.
What I'm trying to get at is that's a region where Danwell Mesa better be getting at least something vaguely right in terms of ionization states using the opal opacities. And the opal opacities claim to include ionization energy. So I'm trying to get straight about it. You're going to now tell me it's not being handled, but opal says it is being handled.
What's the boundary temperature for opal? What's the boundary? The lower temperature for the opal tables?
3.6 log 10.
A way to rephrase that is, I think if you, what Bill's saying is, if you initialized some structure like this in Mesa,
mm-hmm.
turned hydro on, if it actually wanted to become unbound, it should, right?
But it does. Well, we did calculations with Mesa, but not also with Mesa, because initially the calculations were not done with Mesa.
Yeah.
The whole point.
There are two things. I mean, you can do it in 3D and it will be unbound, and you can do it in 1D, because in 1D you can explore way more cases.
The question is whether that ionization energy is accounted for or not. That's the whole point.
It's accounted for in your code.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So it is there.
It is there. It's accounted when it's released for different things. But what I say is that I'm not sure what you calculate in Mesa if you calculate this here. But
I use
it's different,
internal energy
different
from opal.
Hmm?
I use internal energy as given to me by opal, plus the kinetic energy and the potential energy.
Can I ask, you said just when you recombine, it goes into the adiabatic coefficients, right?
Well, I mean, also, it's the molecular weight change. That handles the change in ionization energy.
Coefficients and everything.
You just use an ideal gas law with a molecular weight that depends on density and temperature, and that has the internal energy associated with ionization. There is no separate extra term. It is already all in there. If you imagine a box of gas and you add heat to it, and if that heat is going to make it ionize, then as it ionizes, the molecular weight goes down, which means the internal energy goes up, but the temperature doesn't go up. So basically, that's the the phase change that allows to store extra energy, and you reverse that process. You can take heat out of the box, and the temperature will remain the same because as it recombines, the molecular weight is going up, and so the internal energy is going down.
Well, the way to say it, though, is that the as you go down in recombination, the adiabatic coefficients change, right?
Yep.
The adiabatic gamma.
Yep.
Gamma. I've lost what the question you were asking.
I mean, all of this is calculated self-consistently in MESA. That's not the problem.
Yeah, what is the...
I agree, I think the issue is...
You're worried somebody is double counting?
Yeah, I am. Because, okay, I mean, really, with just an ideal gas law and a molecular weight that
I agree.
Is temperature and density sensitive.
If you're using a right equation of state, you don't want to then add an additional energy source into this equation. So that's kind of the point then.
I mean, changing the molecular weight has no idea how deep you go into the electromagnetic potential to change the ionization state. It's a completely...
Yes, it does. The molecular weight comes from solving Sahar equation.
Ah. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
So it picks up with ionization states, which is why it's...
No, I mean, that's why we need the Sahar equation to evaluate the molecular weight.
What Natasha's really trying to do is separate out the effect of the recombination. Whether you include it in the thermal energy or not,
correct,
it's irrelevant for that. You don't add another term.
Yeah.
In the actual calculation.
The real important point here, just to differentiate from the usual evolution of the star that goes through Hartstrom gap and expands slow on a terminal time scale, so all this energy has time to terminalize and meet it outside slowly. Here, there is a process that expands the star on a dynamical time scale, and now you're injecting this huge amount of energy in a large fraction of the envelope. And now the energy can become comparable to the binding energy. That's your point.
Yes.
Can we think of this in the recombination zone as thinking about the adiabatic exponents that Stan mentioned, that basically you end up in a situation where the local gammas are four-thirds or less, and basically you just get dynamic
instability. Yes, that's exactly the point. The trace weight averaged gamma 1 in this zone becomes less than four-thirds, and this is what leads to this.
Okay.
I get it.
Can I ask a question then? So we are talking then about the stage of the object where we are already in the slow phase. Yeah?
Yes, it's if the dynamical ejection of the envelope did not happen initially.
So I agree with the assessment that the photons can diffuse out quickly due to this very smooth profile of the ionized fractions of the material. But what about convection? How quickly can convection push out the energy?
That's one of the issues which I have. Now, that comes down... So, if we have the recombination working out during 3D, then we don't care, because then recombination kind of also works in a big region, but then it's just thermalized whatever through the SPH code. But in 1D codes, when we try to look at this, and in 1D codes what we do experiments. Experiment means that you tap in some energy, and you look on the reaction of the envelope on the tapping that energy. And you can experiment whether you do the uniform heating or some shell heating. So you can do different kind of experiments. Now, so here what we also have is that you have this expansion, this big recombination of the layers. Now, in some cases, the envelope... Okay, so what's happening in some cases is that so you try to tap in some energy, and you start recombination. Now, the recombination can be so energetically efficient that it taps in even more energy per unit of time than you provided initially with your artificial heating. And then it just leads to the runaway of an envelope. And I don't really care about this because there's a really, really lots of energy release. What I really worry about is, so in some cases, this recombination works relatively fast, that you create a really high local luminosity flux. Now, that local luminosity flux cannot be taken by radiation because your opacity locally, where you have recombined material, goes up. it increases.
Where it's recombined?
In the recombined helium region, the capacity goes up. Now, so what happens in this case, you have to have a convection. Now, with this convection, if you calculate the whole luminosity flux, which it has to carry, it appears that first, this is super Eddington, whatever you care about this or not, and second, it's supersonic. Now, and this doesn't happen at the surface layers. It happens roughly here, in a relatively large region of mass. So about 0.2, 0.3 solar masses, very deep inside of a star, are affected by those two things, which you can get from your stellar core. But what really it does, I don't know.
Okay? Well, why is it supersonic?
Because if you calculate at what velocity you have to transfer the convection.
You're saying convective velocity is what
convective velocity becomes supersonic.
That's what the mixing air theory
does. Just right. You calculate it wrong, you get a
wrong. Because it's at the star, it can be super Eddington and transport out very much.
It's not such a high density. Deep in, but not that.
Yes.
I mean, in that situation, if you put in enough energy to unbind it, I don't see that there's an alternative.
It's not unbinding yet.
Sorry, say that again?
This energy is not enough to unbind it.
Oh, anymore. I see. Okay.
So I think this really goes back to the discussion that we had last week between Elliot's talk about super Eddington winds versus what I was thinking. And there's the question of, just because you go above the Eddington limit, doesn't mean you can drive a sustained mass loss if the amount of energy in the driving is not enough to lift the material to infinity. And you have to be very careful, in a steady state model, you have to be very careful about how you treat the energy balance from where you initiate the wind. And so I think what you're doing is a kind of an impulsive type of thing, but in some sense, because the time scale of the diffusion of energy with radiation is so long, it's kind of quasi-steady state in that context. And I think, you know, we can learn a lot by comparing this kind of idea to what would happen if you think about it as a kind of steady state process. And then it really becomes crucial that where you launch this initiative, where you basically make the star want to go outward, whether it or not can sustain that driving to infinity. And so, I guess what I'm trying to say is that this comes back to what the question that you brought up in the very first day. What is the nature of convection or energy transport in the case where you're above the Eddington limit? Is it really a mixing length problem, or is it more like this photon tiring problem? That basically you try to initiate mass loss, but the energy is not there to sustain it. And therefore, you have these failed, and it looks a lot like convection, but it's not thermally driven convection, it's radiation driven convection, which cannot be sustained. Radiation driven outflow, which cannot be sustained. And I think it would be very interesting. I think this is a really key problem that I think Jan Fay's code could address. I don't know if he's here right now. And I would really guess. And so, I think we really want to talk about that in many, many contexts, in many contexts of Elliot's idea of depositing energy in a massive star, in an other envelope, in a kind of steady state way. And here you have this recombination energy being added to the envelope. And it gives rise to this, now the opacity is more complicated because you're allowing the recombination.
But Stan, didn't Natasha just say that the energy deposited is not enough to unbind, so something else happens anyway?
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to link this conversation back to the one we had last week. Because I think they're very much tied together, and I would like to discuss it, and then for me, one of the things I said my initial thing was that I really want to understand the difference between kind of explosive models where you reject mass like a supernova versus steady state problems. You know, whether
whether the pre-supernova, you know, LPVs are steady state or whether they're explosive or not. This is something that Nathan and I have been discussing a lot. But anyway, coming down to this merger process, can you think of the merger as depositing energy into the envelope and then forcing the envelope to drive material away, whether by thermal pressure or by radiation pressure, some combination thereof? And that comes down to understanding what happens when you deposit energy in an envelope, and how does it, in a kind of sustained way, and how does the system respond to that? How does the star respond to that?
At rates where it can't respond to it simply by our standard old convection, or by radiation alone.
It's got convection beyond the standard.
You're outside of the boundaries of that
theory that says you can't have supersonic convection. Yep. So when I gave my talk, remember I put that limit on the mass loss rate you could have that had the sound speed in it. So why can't you have it supersonic? Maybe you can. Maybe it's some kind of modified sound speed that involves radiation pressure. But yeah, anyway,
pretty clear that doesn't happen.
These are the issues.
You do not get efficient supersonic convection in the on-phase calculation so far. Just, I'm confused about the energetics. I thought the whole point is you puff up the envelope to the point where recombination energy is enough to unbind it. So now you're saying...
No. I mean, it's not... So here, there are different aspects of that, okay? It's a different regime. So this will be rather in this self-regulated regime.
Okay.
Now, this may work out during this stage, but it also can transfer in this stage when the part of the envelope still remains and it's slowly outflowing, but maybe not outflowing. But this is a rather self-regulated regime, which will stay for years because you decreased your orbital energy depletion. Now you don't know what to do. So it has to end, but there's different ways how to end. Okay. But it's some kind of intermittent stage during this ending. It may lead to the end through these pulsations, etc. Because the envelope is really unstable. I mean, gamma 1 is freaking out less than minus 4/3 for the whole envelope. So it has to be pulsational unstable. But also the question is whether the structure that we get has any proper relation to what it might have when the pulsations start.
I think the situations are very similar to the inflated envelopes, of massive stars, where the Eddington limit is hit inside the envelope.
Yeah.
So then what you're saying, that super Eddington, I guess that statement comes from just looking at the total luminosity, but you don't know how much to subtract for the convective luminosity, perhaps. And you say it's supersonic, so What we would do in a 1D code is we would not allow the convection speed to exceed the sonic velocity, so you can modify
the gas sonic velocity. That's to say A squared is P over P gas over rho. But there's another sonic velocity that Elliot talked about in his talk is A squared is equal to P rad over rho.
But you can also exceed that. I think there's a very interesting question, which is
so
the most relevant.
So if you limit the velocity for convection, then you'll start to build up locally like a heat bubble?
Yeah, so what would happen is your envelope would expand further.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what happens in the massive star model.
It's a log inflation, unless you get porosity.
So that's be the result of the 1D calculation.
In 1D you can't be porosity, but in 2D and 3D.
Yeah, but here you're very deep. So porosity might not really solve your problem.
Porosity should be very effective where the optic cuts are large because if you have clumping, then photons have to avoid the clumping and they'll take the least pass. Porosity is actually more effective.
Although
again, inside the star.
Depends on how large density fluctuation you can get.
Yes. That's why
you make the
porosity is another thing we need to.
What we find in the deep calculation is the density fluctuation are not very large.
Yeah, then you
that's because you start your instability at the iron bump, and then down below there's not any structure. But if you start an instability at the base, and you'll generate porosity right from the base, porosity will not be a surface effect, it'll be a deep-seated effect.
What I'm telling you, that we did the deep calculation in that case.
That's for only with the iron bump. The iron bump doesn't make you have to have the instability when you get to the iron bump. When you go deeper down,
you're basically
I'm telling you that we did a simulation where the diurnal flash debunk is very deep in the star.
Right, but then convection takes over. Then
and
convection
that's the situation, yes.
Then the convection takes over and you don't need to have convection dominates over porosity in that moment. What we're talking about is
Let's see how it carries. At the left part of the scale. Right?
Sure, this is a completely different picture, but
moving right along.
It is discussion, right?
Is there any observation of this kind of puff at red giants?
Well, see, I mean, even if we say that it's a long time scale, it's unlikely it will live more than 100,000 years in this state.
So it's too short to
yes.
have some... And
it's also difficult to identify.
It's difficult to identify. I see. It would be more luminous.
It would be
in a
dust.
Right. It would look like a red giant.
But don't you at least have a transit during the plunging?
Plunging, yeah, sure, but...
So is it what
well, it actually might be identified because, so, Philip's student... He calculated that, and I asked him to look how it can be identified. So there will be pulsations. I mean, I already said that this envelope is pulsating, right? It will be unperiodic pulsations. Well, how to say, periodic but not symmetric pulsations, which means that you will not have something like this, but instead of you will be something like this. So it will be not standard pulsations, which will be oscillating in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram somewhere very far here. Which is like high luminosity and temperature is only about 3.4. So it will be very cold, very luminous, giant with non-symmetric pulsations.
And dusty, as Nathan, and probably very dusty, as Nathan emphasized.
Yes.
If it's been losing mass in the early phase, it's going to be
yes.
crap.
Yes.
So the observation has been mentioned, and we have one case where we know there wasn't like like this, which is B1309 scope. My question for you, so with that in context, is in your plot here, as a function of time, where the outburst in luminosity, which was observed
for B1309 scope?
Yeah, where it will be produced, in the plunging phase or in the dynamical? Okay, good. Yeah.
It's here, it's a merger, I'm sorry. I mean, this is then we'll get outburst of the material here.
Right.
I mean, we had a light curve for also calculated for this, but it's there.
Yeah.
It's not very much further.
And we know that there is a lot of dust which has been formed, and maybe something is happening underneath, but it's going to be unlikely that we're going to see it.
In this process, is the angular momentum could help in order to...
Okay, see, so here is the issue. Your angular momentum is really proportional to the distance, right? So what is happening, you're losing most of your angular momentum by this point. So independent of, I'm actually now trying to think, but I think that for the cases when you could have a range of post-common envelope separations, your post-common envelope separations will be rather defined by how efficiently your companion lost its angular momentum here. And so that will define post-common envelope separation rather than the energy, and then your excessive energy just will be taken away with the kinetic energy at the infinity. But unfortunately, if you think about what fraction of your initial angular momentum in your final binary is less than 1% usually for compact binaries. So, I mean, you can have uncertainty of 10%, which will lead absolutely like an incredible range of post-common envelope separations. So unfortunately, angular momentum, which is usually better conserved than energy, it just doesn't help. Because if you have a very small fluctuation of the angular momentum conservation, it leads to a big range of post-common envelope separation.
So you were asking about the outcome of this process for the red giant. So one connection has been made between this process and the outcome is the existence of this class of red giants, which are fast rotating.
Mm-hmm.
It's called FK Comi.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, five or four observed in the galaxy. But and I think the idea is that out of all this madness, you get this star which is rotating rapidly and is active. And probably, that doesn't live in that state for much long because it spins down.
And you know what? I looked on the failed common envelope events, so when you don't eject the envelope, But what unfortunately I have found is that really most of angular momentum is taken here with the third subjective, which happens even for the mergers. And what you're left with, your giant, okay, it's rotating faster than it was, because usually it doesn't rotate much, but I couldn't push it more than 10% of the Keplerian. Just could not.
Most of the angular momentum is simply ejected.
Yes.
So can you, I guess I'm slightly confused about this picture of self-regulated, mm-hmm. forget what DD stands for. So some cases you get this large, long-lived envelope that's recombining and doing all this interesting stuff. Yeah. Other cases you don't.
Yeah, so if you manage to dynamically eject at this
envelope.
Point when your orbital dissipation becomes less than about 10 and minus 4 by the orbital period, if you have dynamically ejected plus what the hell the combination here, then you formed binary at C2 promptly. Oh. Otherwise, not.
Okay.
Otherwise, you move into this.
And we don't really understand when you do each of those.
No.
Well, set having it settle down is basically when you eject the entire hydrogen envelope, right? You're getting down.
No, you're getting down when the separation between the mass of your envelope and the orbit here is becoming more than 6 about. Then you'd kind of drag more orbital energy from the too short now compact binary. It's not when an ejection, it's when they decoupled.
So there's 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 4?
It's roughly.
Sorry, but I just want to understand what that is. That's the orbital time scale divided by the spiral time scale?
Okay, no. So you formed here basically, I'll call it P, like after post, like post plunge. So the delta AP or AP over one orbital period is less than 10 and minus 2.
Okay.
That's roughly the definition.
I think that's what I meant by the ratio of the spiral time scale to the orbital time scale. But
I'm confused to what extent this direct ejection picture has been now confirmed numerically. So,
what kind of ejection?
Yeah, the direct common envelope ejection in this plunge-in phase. You say if that works in this phase, then there is no problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, to what extent is this picture confirmed by the numerical models? So if you do a hydro model where your energy you gain by the spiral in exceeds the potential energy of the envelope by a factor of 100. So then there's no problem to eject the envelope.
It's still a problem.
So then I don't understand what you said by if this works directly, then there's no
okay, problem. I can try to explain because there's no even like a strong formulation in my head. But so what happens here? So first you eject about 40% of the envelope here, dynamically when just you plug in kinetic, mechanical energy, whatever. Now, so what is happening with the rest of the envelope, it starts to move. Like, when it's moving and puffing up, like it has some velocity, expansion velocity. When it's expanding, at some point it becomes dynamically decoupled from this. But now it's the question, if it crosses this recombination radius fast, then it will be continued dynamically ejected, because once it's come here, it's ejected, recombines, ejected. And it's kind of exponential process because your mass inside is only getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
And you see that in numerical models?
Yes. I see that in the prompt dynamical formations.
Right?
Sir?
Calculations with your student.
Yes.
Yeah. Pointed out.
Now, but if the mass of a companion is smaller and it doesn't tap in enough mechanical energy, then the envelope kind of very slowly diffuses up. It's already also decoupled, but the velocity at which it crosses this recombination radius is very small. It creates some very, very slow mass outflows, and the structure kind of goes into this, but we cannot do that structure on a very long time scale. Okay, so the orbital depletion becomes like about 10 and minus 4 at this regime. We know that the cell mass is like a.
So, but what is the predictive power then in this, you know, initial simple energy criteria? Is there anything left of that, or does it all? So if I tell you your initial binary configuration is like this, are you going to be able to tell me whether a common envelope...
We have for some set of binaries, for prompt binary formations, we have calculated the outcomes. But it's only for a limited range, and I don't know how far it can be extrapolated.
So if you're saying this energy form is not working at all, then we can forget about all population synthesis.
No, it works. It works.
Okay, that's better than being.
No, so it works for low mass stars better than for massive stars, because in low mass stars you don't have this problem. You like your binding energy of envelope is much better defined because your hydrogen layer is very tiny and you will not remove it. Now, so what is happening? So we only did it for low mass stars, and for more massive stars, I'm sorry. Yes, you're in trouble so far. I mean, you can do any kind of population synthesis you want. I will not trust it any, at least now. So for low mass stars, where the binding energy is better defined, we know how much kinetic energy can be taken in infinity, and we know how much recombination energy is stored. In this case, you can redefine the energy formulas, not in a regional way, where you have lambda and alpha, but just to write down how, like, take this kinetic energy, calculate this, and then you can find post-common envelope separations. They comes out kind of nice, but not yet for massive stars. And for massive stars, probably, yes, here, and bottom.
Can you compare that to the systems which we believe have been through this phase, right? And
for massive stars?
No, for low mass stars.
Yeah, for low mass stars, yes. For low mass stars, things are way, way more certain.
So what's the physical difference between the low mass case and the high mass case? Why are they different?
Okay, for a low mass case, your hydrogen layer is about 10^-3 solar masses.
What do you mean your hydrogen layer?
The hydrogen burning shell layer.
Oh.
And you eject everything on the top. So you are much better in defining what's your integration point for the binding energy.
Okay.
But I will not bet $100 on what you know well that for massive stars. I mean, I did my best, which I trusted, but I still will not bet.
On the other hand, of course, we need to have a good theory, but can we look at some observations of some, I would say, descendants of this kind of evolution in order to see how frequent it is?
It interferes with a lot of other unknown physics, like supernova kicks and God knows
what. Yeah, you don't know how many...
You may do it for some descendants, which I don't know which one will be the best. See, I mean, with low mass stars, who have very, very good restriction, which is based on that, as you know, that the radius of a red giant is a function of its core mass in some power, I don't remember, like about 6, right? So if you see now a white dwarf of some specific mass, you have a very good handle on what was that star at the start of a common envelope. If we will have something like that for massive stars, it would be great.
This doesn't tell you the total mass, I think.
It doesn't tell you the total mass, but the range is really small if you will try to play with all the possible ranges of envelope masses, well, the total masses.
So this really only works for the low mass stars, which have degenerate.
Yes, yes, yes.
Even intermediate mass stars. Right?
Yes.
Not understood in that respect.
Yeah.
And which is the key observations that you're then calibrating to or saying are well understood from?
It's for double white dwarfs formation, for like close binary symmetric white dwarfs, where you know that the younger white dwarf was formed through the color for the common envelope.
Okay. But sub dwarfs in closed binaries are very good because then you know exactly the properties of the progenitors.
So, but would my all three X-ray binaries help as a final product of something?
But you said that they did not evolve for common envelope.
I still hope that seven are also made by common envelopes.
Oh, you want to take it back, huh?
I mean, it will be perfect just to observe some one Fourier star, which is very close to a black hole, and you see lots of still moving the wave material around, so you say, oh, that's a recent post-Cohen envelope event.
But this very dusty object, which I mentioned yesterday at the end of my talks, you know, this integral X-ray binary, which is enormously obscured and has this enormous infrared flux, it looks like something which is doing some moving in. So,
maybe.
Does anyone know what the B bracket E star actually is? What is the B bracket E star?
It's a binary
You mean how do you make one, or what is the definition of it?
Yeah, how do you make it?
It's got a torus with forbidden emission lines, and they all have lots of dust.
Okay.
They all have a strong infrared excess.
And does anyone know why they make this dust? Well, they are still a B star?
Because they get the disk gets so far away, it cooled enough to make dust.
The disk is at like 1,000 acres.
The disk goes
so there's a disk around.
The torus, yeah, whatever.
Torus, whatever.
Oh, okay.
So going back to my question about the core versus envelope, the boundary. I mean, if I make a model of like a 15 solar mass red supergiant, there's a huge density jump between the core and envelopes, which is very sudden in mass coordinate. So I still don't understand why it's so hard to define.
How do you define? What's your definition of the point? So, well, I mean, then, yes, I know that
there is.
So you have this. So this is your E binding energy, right?
Sure.
But that's the thing. So this is the bottom of a common envelope or a convective envelope. This is your core. But there is a range here which changes your binding energy by a factor of 15, depending on where you put your start of integration point.
But if I say I plot density,
there's
basically a density jump by a factor
of 1
million. That's at a very narrow range in mass, so I could just...
Yeah,
what
that,
happens if
the
I just
narrow
that
range
mass coordinate?
That has this large density contrast also has a large binding energy contrast.
No, it doesn't. Because it's a very small range in mass.
So I think, was it John Jenholm who looked at the density jump? I think somebody was looking in the past on the density jump. So, I mean, see, that's what I said. So there is like a three or four different definitions of where you start your core.
Right.
And people have argued different things. I mean, you definitely should remove all the convective envelope, because if you don't remove enough, then it just will expand its reaction, right? But how far deep? I'm not sure about the density, because see, I mean, when I looked on this, for me, if I would take the mass above this, and as I take the mass, I mean like you remove the mass at one solar mass a year rate. I mean, it's really fast,
right?
So if I take the mass and then I'll stop here like at different points, and then I look on the evolution of those points after the mass removal, so the points below this will contract, the points above will expand. And it's not related to the density, or to maybe it's related to the density drop, but for me it was P over rho to be maximum. So, but they found something else. Some other people found also something else. So everybody has its own kind of definitions.
Is that really true? I mean, I understand if you're in the self-regulated phase that the star has a lot of time to readjust, but if you're in the plunging phase, wonder whether the envelope can be ejected as air or not. Is the stellar readjustment important? Because that, in a sense, goes on a thermal time scale, right? So
yes, but the thermal time scale of a core is short, right?
Yeah, but shorter than the dynamical time scale of the plunging.
Maybe not.
Because if not, then, you know, I stick to what I said before. You don't need to look at lambda. You could just integrate your potential energy and see how much orbital energy you have, and you're done.
But you don't know in advance how much orbital energy you have, right? I don't understand that argument.
Well, you can go as far down as the binding energy allows you to, or
you mean,
needs you.
But you really mean orbital energy?
What's the energy is
for us?
Orbital.
So,
this is still my confusion too. If I say E final minus E initial is an integral into the star, and I find the first point where I actually have an equality of binding energy equals E orbital final minus E orbital initial, which I think
let's put it this way.
That's just a well-defined condition.
Yeah, but how do you think in advance E orbital final?
You don't. You do the integral. And you find where you actually reach equality.
You can't do that. Okay. Sorry, but you have two unknowns, right? I mean, you have the e-orbital final, which you don't know in advance, and you have the point to which you have to keep on integrating, the mass coordinate or radial coordinate up to which you integrate. So I understand you have an equation, but you have two unknowns in this equation.
They're related. You find the point where they're consistent with each other.
Yeah,
the problem is this point may be at some point, and then you can in principle eject all the energy above, all the mass above. But the mass below will
may
expand.
Want to, yeah, no, that that's I the got. Issue. That's back to this dynamical versus thermal. Right. Then. Let's see.
So you can find an energetic condition in solar, but it doesn't mean it's the right answer.
Sorry.
I think it's back to this time scale issue. If it's happening fast enough that...
You'd have a time scale of how long it takes to get into that point.
Yes.
And that would be helpful for temporary transits.
There is some discussion in a recent paper on this.
Okay. Which paper?
Matthias Krukow.
Okay. I think we had good enough discussion.
One more question. Sorry. So I think, I mean... This goes back to your point that you know, pop synth for massive stars is hopeless. So I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm asking a question. So the question is the following. I mean, I think everybody agrees that at least some massive stars probably go through a successful common envelope projection. For example, the observations of galactic binary stars would very strongly suggest that, right? Now, we don't know exactly, as Philip and Norbert have pointed out, for example, that we don't know about the supernova, we don't know lots of other things. We cannot exactly infer from that what the common envelope parameters were and so on. But the question is, can you imagine some other parametrization of the common envelope other than with alpha and lambda, which may not be very useful quantities because alpha is not universal and lambda is poorly defined and so on, can we imagine some other parametrization where we could say, yes, we don't know what the parameters are, but using this parametrization in a Poisson simulation will allow us to make some predictions where later we can actually try to infer the relevant
quantities. That's what I said here. So once you know your binding energy of an envelope, or you think that you know your binding energy of an envelope, then you have a reasonable guess about your kinetic energy at infinity, and we found that it's between 25% and 45% of your final orbital energy, like in specific units. You have your recombination energy, and that will be good enough. Well, I guess it's better, way better than anything that's now. Now, but my own problem is that I do not trust the binding energy of envelope. Because I still disagree that you can just integrate in, because I think that the core reacts differently.
But the argument is that it might be useful to think of first a dynamical phase where you can integrate it, and then a thermal phase where there's additional evolution that happens, but maybe by breaking it up into those two phases, it becomes slightly more trapped.
Yes, and we cannot yet well divide in those which dynamically end and which will not end dynamically. Because when I try to look on those kind of failed, which lead to the slow spiraling, they will be predicted to be, it's a prompt binary formation. Sorry, it's a normal binary formation, but I don't know how to predict that it will go into slow spiraling. And that's for low mass stars where things are easier.
Can you briefly just comment on luminous red novae and generally what types of transients this might produce and what we're learning?
I'm not to talk about this.
Okay. Because that seems like a place where there's actually going to be, there is progress on the observational
side.
Yes.
You can also kind of add into the time scales of this plot. It sounds like the self-regulated phase is very long, right?
Yes.
And it's this brief phase that would be a transient. It's just the initial plunge in.
That's one of the places where you can get luminous red novae. It's your dynamical ejector during the merger, so fast prompt dynamical ejection. Here or like all the way here. Now here I don't think you'll get luminous red novae. You'll have this puffed up envelope. Now, I don't know actually how it looks like this ejection during those pulsations, but it was found that those pulsations will also lead to the mass ejector. But the luminous rig novae, which at least the model which we had in mind, includes the recombination as you go. So basically, because you have recombination roughly at some fixed radii, then it will fix the photosphere and will fix your luminosity and make the luminosity plateau. For those guys, I don't know. So it seems to me that if you want to see luminous rig novae, they will be at this period. For mergers, like initial stage, for dynamical prompt ejection somewhere here. So, but only during the fast prompt binary formations.
So Philip Student's calculation. So he's finding ejections of a significant amount of mass.
Yeah, that's what I say. So there's some mass ejections here, but I don't know how the light curve will look like and whether it will be related to luminous rig novae, because the material which you have here will be already recombined. It will be ejected by different things, right? So it will not, I do not see it to be comparable as a light curve to luminous rig novae. I might be wrong, but it has to be calculated.
Quick applause.